that the Nestorians weren't the only teachers available for the Arabs. Throughout all the rich cities of the East, the kindred Jews were scattered with their own distinctive literature and tradition, and the Arab and the Jewish mind reacted upon one another to a common benefit. The Arab was informed and the Jew sharpened to a keener edge. The Jews have never been pedants in the matter of their language. We've already noted that 1,000 years before Islam they spoke Greek in Hellenized Alexandria, and now all over this new Muslim world they were speaking and writing Arabic. Some of the greatest of Jewish literature was written in Arabic, the religious writings of Maimonides, for example. Indeed, it's difficult to say, in the case of this Arabic culture, where the Jew ends and the Arab begins, so important and essential were its Jewish factors. Moreover, there was a third source of inspiration, more particularly in mathematical science, to which at present it's difficult to do justice, India. There can be little doubt that the Arab mind, during its best period, was in effective contact with Sanskrit literature and with Indian ideas, and that it derived much from this source. The distinctive activities of the Arab mind were already manifest under the Umayyads, though it was during the Abbasid time that it made its best display. History is the beginning and core of all sound philosophy and all great literature, and the first Arab writers of distinction were historians, biographers, and quasi-historical poets. Romantic fiction and the short story followed as a reading public developed, willing to be amused. And as reading ceased to be a special accomplishment and became necessary to every man of affairs and to every youth of breeding, came the systematic growth of an educational system and an educational literature. By the 9th and 10th centuries, there weren't only grammars but great lexicons and a mass of philological learning in Islam. And a century or so in advance of the West, there grew up in the Muslim world at a number of centers, at Basra, at Kufa, at Baghdad and Cairo, and at Cordoba, out of what were at first religious schools dependent upon mosques, a series of great universities. The light of these universities shone far beyond the Muslim world and drew students to them from east and west. At Cordoba, in particular, there were great numbers of Christian students, and the influence of Arab philosophy coming by way of Spain upon the universities of Paris, Oxford, and North Italy, and upon Western European thought generally, was very considerable indeed. The name of Averroes, Ibn Rushd of Cordoba, 1126 to 1198, stands out as that of the culminating influence of Arab philosophy upon European thought. He developed the teachings of Aristotle upon lines that made a sharp division between religious and scientific truth, and so prepared the way for the liberation of scientific research from the theological dogmatism that restrained it, both under Christianity and under Islam. Another great name is that of Avicenna, Ibn Sina, the Prince of Physicians, 980 to 1037, who was born at the other end of the Arabic world, at Bukhara, and who travelled in Khorasan. The book-copying industry flourished at Alexandria, Damascus, Cairo, and Baghdad, and about the year 970, there were 27 free schools open in Cordoba for the education of the poor. In mathematics, say Thacher and Schwill, the Arabs built on the foundations of the Greek mathematicians. The origin of the so-called Arabic numerals is obscure. Under Theodoric the Great, Boethius made use of certain signs which were in part very like the 9 digits which we now use. One of the pupils of Gebert also used signs which were still more like ours, but the zero was unknown until the 12th century, when it was invented by an Arab mathematician named Muhammad ibn Musa, who also was the first to use the decimal notation, and who gave the digits the value of position. In geometry, the Arabs didn't add much to Euclid, but algebra is practically their creation. Also, they developed spherical trigonometry, inventing the sine, tangent, and cotangent. In physics, they invented the pendulum and produced works on optics. They made progress in the science of astronomy. They built several observatories and constructed many astronomical instruments which are still in use. They calculated the angle of the ecliptic and the precession of the equinoxes. Their knowledge of astronomy was undoubtedly considerable. In medicine, they made great advances over the work of the Greeks. They studied physiology and hygiene, and their materia medica was practically the same as ours today. Many of their methods of treatment are still in use among us. The surgeons understood the use of anesthetics and performed some of the most difficult operations known. At the time when in Europe the practice of medicine was forbidden by the church, which expected cures to be effected by religious rites performed by the clergy, the Arabs had a real science of medicine. In chemistry, they made a good beginning. They discovered many new substances such as alcohol, potash, nitrate of silver, corrosive sublimate, and nitric and sulfuric acid. In manufactures, they outdid the world in variety and beauty of design and perfection of workmanship. They worked in all the metals, gold, silver, copper, bronze, iron, and steel. In textile fabrics, they have never been surpassed. They made glass and pottery of the finest quality. They knew the secrets of dyeing, and they manufactured paper. They had many processes of dressing leather, and their work was famous throughout Europe. They made tinctures, essences, and syrups. They made sugar from the cane and grew many fine kinds of wine. They practiced farming in a scientific way and had good systems of irrigation. They knew the value of fertilizers and adapted their crops to the quality of the ground. They excelled in horticulture, knowing how to graft and how to produce new varieties of fruit and flowers. They introduced into the West many trees and plants from the East and wrote scientific treatises on farming. One item in this account must be underlined here because of its importance in the intellectual life of mankind, the manufacture of paper. This the Arabs seem to have learnt from the Chinese by way of Central Asia. The Europeans acquired it from the Arabs. Until that time, books had to be written upon parchment or papyrus, and after the Arab conquest of Egypt, Europe was cut off from the papyrus supply. Until paper became abundant, the art of printing was of little use, and newspapers and popular education by means of books was impossible. This was probably a much more important factor in the relative backwardness of Europe during the Dark Ages than historians seem disposed to admit. And all this mental life went on in the Muslim world in spite of a very considerable amount of political disorder. From first to last, the Arabs never grappled with the problem, the still unsolved problem, of the stable, progressive state. Everywhere, their form of government was absolutist and subject to the convulsions, changes, intrigues, and murders that have always characterized the extremer forms of monarchy. But for some centuries, beneath the crimes and rivalries of courts and camps, the spirit of Islam did preserve a certain general decency and restraint in life. The Byzantine Empire was impotent to shatter this civilization, and the Turkish danger in the northeast gathered strength only very slowly. Until the Turk fell upon it, the intellectual life of Islam continued. Perhaps it secretly flattered itself that it would always be able to go on in spite of the thread of violence and unreason in its political direction. Hitherto in all countries, that has been the characteristic attitude of science and literature. The intellectual man has been loath to come to grips with the forcible man. He's generally been something of a courtier and time server. Possibly he's never yet been quite sure of himself. Hitherto, men of reason and knowledge have never had the assurance and courage of the religious fanatic. But there can be little doubt that they have accumulated settled convictions and gathered confidence during the last few centuries, they've slowly found a means to power through the development of popular education and popular literature, and today they're far more disposed to say things plainly and to claim a dominating voice in the organization of human affairs than they have ever been before in the world's history.